Be in front of your TV sets for the horror-thon, and remember the big giveaway at 9. Don't miss it, and don't forget to wear your masks. The clock is ticking. It's almost time.
Silver Shamrock my ass.
You're gonna need a bigger pouch.
Welcome to the Graveyard Shit Podcast.
You're gonna die in there! All of you! You are gonna die!
Hey everyone, welcome back to the Graveyard Shit Podcast. We got something good for you today. You can see it in the background of Rob's video. We got a double feature, The Burning, and In a Violent Nature. Do I want to use the word classics? I kind of want to use the word classics. In a Violent Nature's new, but, you know, let's say that two cult classics. I think everyone can agree on that.
Well, one a cult for sure, one that may be a cult classic quicker than most.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, so we're going back to camp with some killers. And honestly, let's be truthful. Some of them, you know, non-generic killers. You know, there have been a lot of Friday the 13th clones, you know. But both of these films had killers that are, I wouldn't consider either of these really like a Jason Voorhees clone.
No.
You know?
No. In fact, I was thinking about that earlier today. I really do think In a Violent Nature has gained more from The Burning really than it has from Friday, only in the sense that The Burning really was a nod to Friday the 13th and that whole movement, even though, you know, two was being made at the same time and Savanni made his, you know, to do The Burning and not, but I mean, obviously there's a Jason nod, there's a Friday night, but when you really watch these two movies, they both in their own ways are going after very, very similar things that maybe seem mirror each other more.
Yeah.
Than, 'cause they're both respecting Friday. But as they're doing that, they're probably mirroring each other more than they're anything. I mean, and I didn't think about this. I mean, when we offered up this as an idea to do, I didn't even think about that. I just thought, well, everyone expects you're going to talk nature, you're going to talk Friday. Well, let's throw another camp, you know, summer camp slasher. And it wasn't until I actually revisited The Burning and had revisited nature and I thought, holy crap, these two really do go together.
They do. And I mean, it's, how can I put this? Part of it is, one of the things is like with the Friday films and with Jason and everything, you know, there's not really any motive to him killing. You know, there's the thing, like, oh, you know, like maybe he saw his mother get beheaded and that's why he's killing them and everything. In both The Burning and In a Violent Nature, there are concrete reasons why they are doing the things they are. In The Burning, it's pure revenge. And in a Violent Nature, it's pure, like, you stole my shit and I want it back.
And there is quite a bit of revenge in there in terms of how he goes after the Ranger.
Yeah.
Because there is something really personal going on with that junk.
Definitely. Definitely.
And there is a lot in there, man. I mean, you know, okay, so I don't know. Let's start with just real quick. What's your history of both? Separately.
Okay, starting with the burning, I came into the burning late because for some reason, whenever I had about maybe four video stores around my place, none of them had it. None of them, not a single one. You could find Friday the 13th, Burning, you could never find. I was introduced to the Burning, and anyone listening from Britain will remember these, Vipco DVDs. They all had like the same kind of cover, like a black cover. It would say the name of the movie, you know, and that's where I first saw The Burning. I don't know if it was uncut. I'm betting it wasn't. I'm betting there was stuff cut out of it. But I remember seeing it on the UK DVD and just loving it. Because it was everything I wanted from a Friday the 13th film, but it wasn't a Friday the 13th film. You know, it was a strange situation in where I was given everything I wanted, but it wasn't Jason. It was someone else. And I loved it for that. And I just, the Burning is just so great. It really is. As for In a Violent Nature, I saw it in the theater. I think I saw it in the theater. Did I see it in the theater? I don't know if I saw it. I might have seen it in the theater, or I might have seen it, like, I might have downloaded it and watched it then. I know
you,
I
might have. You might have, because it seems like I vaguely remember you saying, really, you haven't seen it yet? Which I would.
Yeah. I think one or the other. Either I saw a downloaded copy of it or I saw it in the theater. One or the other. I thoroughly loved it. I saw right from the beginning what they were going for. And it's a unique take on like the summer camp slasher film. But it was a take that I really appreciated. Now, some people will argue, you know, oh, it's boring or whatever. You know what? I don't care. You know, we have never seen a film from the slasher's point of view, other than Behind the Mask, right? Yeah. Leslie Vernon.
He's a character. Not quite like this. Not quite.
Yeah,
like
he's this. A character that talks and, you know, and like can emote and everything. This is from like a silent slasher. And I just loved it. But the one thing I really, really liked about In a Violent Nature was you see our main, our hero character, if you will, do all these horrible things, but with the exception of one, and you know we were just talking about it. None of it seems really personal. Like, he's killing these people because they stole something from him, essentially. But it's more like if they'd just given it back, I think he'd have just took it and left.
Yeah, well, Ranger. Yeah. There's something about perhaps something going on with him in terms of recollecting and resurfacing memories that trigger things. Yeah. Like when he sees, you know, I think it's Aaron with the Ranger t-shirt on. That's a trigger point. You know, sounds trigger him. You know, he hears the gunshots. He goes off. He hears the car going by. He trails after. And he's like attracted to sounds.
Yeah.
You know, and he's sort of a visual creature too, because I mean, he sees the traps on the ground.
Oh yeah.
He stares at the, you know,
I almost want to say he's almost like, it's going to sound really weird saying this, but hear me out. He's almost like somebody with ADD. Like, you know, he's going one way and then he hears like a noise over here. So he goes over there, you know, right. It's like, but at the same time, he's smart enough to realize stuff that's going on around him and stuff, you know. And at the same time, there's almost like an innocence to his character. Yeah, I almost say he's like a kid.
Yeah.
You know, he's like a kid with anger problems and ADD.
With a very interesting history.
Yeah.
I think, you know, I was fortunate enough to, you know, on a few occasions bring The Burning home from the VHS, from, you know, renting VHS tapes back in the day, back in the, you know, the height of the Tom Savini, you know, and Fangoria and, you know, just, you know, just getting your hands on anything and everything this guy was doing. I mean, you know, the Prowler. I mean, I mean, it doesn't take long for me to visualize certain VHS boxes in the store, and then, you know, grabbing them. So, I mean, I was, but it's weird because I think I don't recollect The Burning being like on the top of the heap as far as my go-tos. Like, mm-hmm. I would have seen it. I would have, you know, the raft scene would have been freaking gnarly. I probably wouldn't have known as a kid, you know, or a teenager. I wouldn't have really known what to do with the opening scene versus the stalk and slash of the woods and just, you know, and the setup, of course. The raft scene, you know, that would have been just seeing that raft just floating down the river is just freaking nuts. Oh, yeah. It's got to be one of the most disturbing moments and actually nature has a similar, almost similar when you're way back view looking at the cliffside and then he pushes her over, you know, or what's left of her, moments like that. So, I mean, so that's been with me since the early days. But I mean, as a kid, to be honest, I probably got more excited when the trailer or the TV spot dropped for Phantasm 2, you know, this summer, the ball is back, you know, over the top sequels that were coming out. I mean, I love my Fridays. I didn't get to see Friday in the theater until 3. But from there on out, I mean, I was pretty much, I mean, in it. But with nature, when I first saw the trailer online, and think this is what, 40? I wrote it down somewhere. Is this like 43 years later? 43 years separating these two films. I mean, that's insane. I saw the trailer drop online. I was intrigued. I mean, I was really, really intrigued. And then somewhere from that viewing to when the movie finally came out, I don't know, the buzz of it kind of wore off, I guess, and I really was dragging my feet whether I was going to see it or not. And and Sam, my oldest boy, he finally convinced me one day, let's go see this. Let's go see this. And I was just like, eh, all right. And so by the time we got there, I got myself in the right mindset, right? Because I knew it was going to be, if not a slow burn, it was at least going to be very methodically paced out from what I've heard. So, I mean, I got my mind in the right place and I got in, sat down, and okay. When it started, I was like, all right, I'm ready. Let's do this thing. And when I walked out, I was like, all right, I dig this. Now, mm-hmm. 4 or 5 viewings later, especially for this tonight, mm-hmm. I have some really interesting thoughts about this junk. I love one of my – and it's funny, you read some of the criticisms or some of the reviews, and the one scene people love to criticize is the final car ride at the end.
I love that scene.
I love that. I mean, it gives you a chance, especially after I think the last kill is the multiple, you know, acts, you know, can't stop, and it's finally get to a point where, okay, you know, now it's, you hear it off screen and you know it's still going on, but like, dude, man, dude's just not stopping. I don't know. I think, wasn't that Aaron? That was Evan. Was that Evan? I think that was Evan. Actually, we'll have to go through all the castings, or at least the character names, because it is really interesting, the differences between Nature and the Burning, in terms of their characters and how they use them. But that car ride, and having the girl who played Vicky in Part 2, Friday Part 2, that might be correct me if I'm wrong, that might be the best freaking cameo or use of a character from a popular old slasher movie I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Because the big ones, when you take a big one, like what's her name from Texas for the new Texas movie, they just seem like they fall flat on their face, and they're just not used the way they should have been used.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Right, but this is one of those where, first of all, she doesn't even really look like Vicky anymore.
No.
But I mean, if you stare at her face long enough, you see it, and when you listen long enough, you sort of hear it. It's there. But that whole story about the bear.
I love that. I love it.
Yeah. It's almost kind of like, you know, it almost acts like a really interesting bookend for when Aaron tells us the story of the history of what happens to this kid. And getting it told again, but via metaphor of a bear attack, which is almost subjective. Really, was it really a bear, or was he just? Yeah. I think about that. There you go. I don't know why that happens, but I wonder. Especially the last time, I think the last few times I watched it, I really wondered: are we really telling a story about a bear, or is this just to help make everyone feel better about what happened? Like, did he run into Johnny?
That's what I assumed when I first saw it. You know, I felt for sure that, you know, it wasn't just a bear. You know, but.
And if it was a bear, then it was a great way for Chris to sort of begin to process and sort of make peace with what's happened.
Yeah.
Like, if she views Johnny as like no different than a bear, it's easier to process and make peace with it and begin to move on.
Mm-hmm.
Which, in a way, I hope we never see her character again. Because sometimes I hate it when movies bring characters back like that. Because usually it doesn't work the way you think or hope it would work. How do you want to do this? How do you want to just go back and forth on whatever pops into our heads?
Might as well, yeah.
Well, I mean, you want to do a quick synopsis?
Yeah, sure.
You want to type, you grab one and then I'll do one. Which one do you want to do? Real quick, just off the top of your head.
Okay. I'll do In a Violent Nature.
All right. I'll do The Burning. Burning really is a typical setup where really you have a terrible prank goes wrong. This is Camp Blackfoot. Actually, is it a different camp from where the accident happens?
No, I think it's the same camp.
Is it? So
they're very close. If it's not,
so you have really, you know. it's a story about a it's a it's dude's a jerk, man. He's a caretaker, and he does not have a good relationship with these kids at all. And anytime he gets a chance to lash out at them, he does. And so we it opens up with a terrible prank gone terribly wrong. And dude's burned to near crisp. And so, you know, it's really a revenge tale. He, you know, he makes his way back to the camp and decides to take out his anger on, well, the kid who is the ringleader of the prank gone bad, Todd.
Yep.
And the group of kids, unaware of the hell they're about to be dropped into when he shows up and begins his havoc. And really, and you know, that's really basically it, except worth to mention, this is a great moment in Tom Savini's career of special effects and just the gore and stuff. So this is a great Tom Savini moment. So really, that is, you know, it in a nutshell. So what about nature?
It about nature is, how do I put it? Bunch of kids are at like summer camp sort of thing. They hear this story of this like deformed kid that died or whatever. They find a place. I'm trying to put it in such a way that, you know, makes sense for people. They find a place and they find a locket there. So one of the guys, you know, being a upstanding citizen that he is, decides, I'm going to take this locket and give it to my girlfriend. This locket belonged to the mother of Johnny.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, Johnny's dead. Johnny's buried. But at the same time, Johnny is undead. He does not take kindly to this. He wants his locket back. And he's going to go through just about everyone to get it. That's really, plot-wise, that's about it. What's great about In a Violent Nature is it tells you nothing. You know, you hear a bit of his backstory, but you hear it from, like, you know, just some people talking, like, you know. It's not spelled out for you. And the thing is also, let's be honest, we call him Johnny. This might not be Johnny. You know, we assume it's Johnny. We assume that, you know, like, all that. This could be something else completely for all we
know. I mean, I think it's a safe assumption. I think there is there's an interesting question as to the nature of who kills the loggers in the aftermath. Yeah. You know, let's talk about that origin, because that is a really intriguing origin that sort of is probably inspired by the origin, that tale that we get from Friday. It's, you know, in the 50s, and you got a logging camp, and Johnny's dad is, owns a series of shops that sell the loggers, probably food, coffee, whatever stuff, but he charges probably more than he should charge, and so the relationship between the loggers and him is not good. And so when Johnny accidentally leaves one of his toys out, and a logger apparently slips on and twists an ankle really bad, loses some work time, they decide to set Johnny up for a terrible prank that leads to his death by falling from the top of a fire tower. And in order to cover their tracks, they throw the fire hat on him and hope that dad, you know, but at least through dialogue, it kind of makes you think about, really makes you think about Pumpkinhead.
Yeah.
You know, if you just visually, mentally, I mean, you don't see any of it, but you kind of think, you know. So he confronts the loggers, and of course, that doesn't end well for Dad. Dad ends up being killed by the loggers, and company settles out, and in a terrible way, too, making the scene look like it was mostly animals that did all the destruction of the bodies and everything.
Yeah.
And that's the question is, who is this? The spirit of Johnny that runs havoc amongst the loggers? Who does this? And it is an interesting, you know, he's a little, well, we don't know how little he is. I don't know if we're ever really told his age.
No.
Is this basically a first, second grader mentality in a big lumbering body who really just acts like a kid? And he is, you know, it's kind of, it might be the easiest way because, I mean, if it's just a little tiny kid, how does he grow? And when he's basically, I mean, he is sleeping though. So presumably he's not even dead. He's just sleeping.
Yeah.
But I don't know how you grow underground or anything. I don't know. It's almost kind of like maybe the best way to envision it is him, a little kid trapped in a huge lumbering, like Tyler Payne.
Yeah.
But he's just a goofy, you know, kid who doesn't know any better and unfortunately gets the better of a prank. And, but see, motivations here are interesting because, you know, the dad, you know, he isn't an angel or anything, and how he treats these, you know, loggers and everything. And yet, you know, their prank goes, you know, a little too far, much like Cropsey.
Yeah.
You know, dude was a nasty son of a, you know what, and how he treated these kids and all they wanted. Cause it's like, when that fire started, the prank gone bad, one of the kids, I wish I knew which one it was. One of the kids screams, "We got to get him out of there."
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's genuine concern, at least in the moment, that this has gone terribly wrong.
Yeah.
But when dude comes busting out the door on a full body burn, man, which is pretty awesome. What are you going to do at that point?
Yeah.
And you know,
run after him and like kick him into a pond or something. I mean, that's pretty much all you could do.
I mean, and you know, and then Todd being the ringleader, it's hard to sympathize with him much.
Yeah.
And you know, as far as how the events will unfold, in that movie, you know, in the rest of the movie, but motivations in both are a little weird and uneven. It's hard to decide exactly who you favor, who you don't favor. I mean, you know, Cropsey isn't your typical where, you know, Jason sort of becomes your hero because, you know, well, all he did was, you know, he didn't know any better, went swimming and drowned, and, you know, mom begins, you know, the whole thing going. Here, the motivations are a little bit different. It's hard for either Cropsey. It's maybe easier for Johnny to be that Jason role than it is for Cropsey, because Cropsey was just a nasty. And what he does to the prostitute, I mean.
Yeah. I always thought with the burning, one thing would have worked a little better if they just changed one thing. And it would have been, if you just think of it this way, remove the character of Cropsey as he is in The Burning, and replace him with the chef from Sleepaway Camp. Then it makes more sense. You have someone who's essentially a predator to begin with, who's then burned or whatever, and then comes back as like a psycho killer sort of thing. But the thing with Cropsey is you do buy it, you know? Is it an overreaction, you know, slaughtering a bunch of kids because you got burned? Probably. But it's a level of rage you can understand.
Well, you know, and I just thought about it, Glenn. He's lost everything. He will forever be ostracized from society. I mean, a prostitute won't even be with him. And that actually might, see, I wonder about that scene. I wonder if she's, if she just welcomes in him into her arms in spite of how he looks, like you said earlier about something else, does he just change course?
Yeah.
Does he lose some of that anger in the process in the arms of a prostitute? Does he lose some of that if he realizes, but she doesn't, and he snaps, and, you know, of course, you know, I'm sure there's still a lot of pain involved with just what happened to him in terms of the just physical pain, you know. So I wonder, like, you know, if Johnny just gets his locket, his back, does he just go somewhere, sit down, and
it seems like it, yeah. He gets his locket, he goes back to sleep.
Yeah, and if this prostitute opens up her arms and just comforts this guy, but instead he unleashes his anger on her and then just embarks about a crusade of slaughter and just, you know, which is interesting because you have to make some assumptions, some leaps, but with his relationship with Todd, obviously, you don't really get anything else other than, you know, Todd is probably the most pissed off of the kids and just wants to get them and get them good. And that one young kid, they kind of got to talk into the prank. He sort of unwillingly kind of goes along with it, which I almost kind of wish that kid would have been your Todd character and not Todd.
Yeah, that would have been a bit better, I think.
Because it doesn't really make a lot of sense when Todd faces Cropsey in the end. He's struggling with his memory bank in terms of what is going on here.
Yeah.
Well, Cropsey ain't struggling because it's pretty obvious to him that he knows who Todd is. And this is why
he
follows them out, you know, Devil's Creek, whatever that was. Follows them, and that's why he just doesn't do the slaughter there at the camp. He follows them out because he's following, you know, and how he uses Alfred to ultimately corner Todd in the end.
Mm-hmm.
And talk about that for a minute. You got 18 freaking people going off up the riverbend. You got Todd and Michelle, and then you've got 16 kids.
Yep.
Half of which aren't coming back.
Yep.
Five could get it on a raft in maybe one of the most epic moments in horror slasher history.
That's one of the few times where you actually see a massacre occur on screen. You know, like, you know, you talk about movies that have massacre in the title, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, you know, there's no real massacre in there, but that is a damn massacre. You know, dude just comes up and wipes them all out. That's like, when you think of it, that's like almost like a generation of these campers are just gone. You know, it's pretty much all the remaining like ones of that age group.
So they go up the river. This movie, they both take a while.
They do.
Really, I mean, except for the initial kill with Cropsey, you know, and the prostitute, they both actually take a while to get into that. I mean, for the most part, I mean, with, you know, nature, well, I mean, the first person killed, the guy, the trapper, I mean, you know, he's dispatched, but that's an interesting scene because the ranger's there getting into an argument with the trapper. And so you can tell, you can learn a lot from this movie when you watch it 2, 4, 5 times. It's interesting how Johnny just watches the ranger drive off and he's sort of stuck on that for a moment.
Yeah.
But then he turns his attention to the house.
Yeah.
And because, you know, he's just starting to, you know, go. But then the first real kill in terms of our collective kids is Aaron, the one who tells the story at the campfire.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who apparently has a pedophile for an uncle. Who told him the story. But his pill is freaking sick, man. What is that? Mm-hmm. What is that? What is that? Like, what was that? What kind of a knife was that called? I wrote all this stuff. A draw knife.
Yeah, yeah.
He just puts it around and just did. Aaron's just up against a tree, listening to his Walkman.
Yeah,
smoking his dube, and just raw, and just sit right there and just takes him.
Oh, man.
And then he drags him off to the – and that's what makes this – and you know what? I'll tell you, one of the things that hit me in the later viewings that I didn't get at first, first one or two viewings, I actually thought – and this is probably stupid on my part, but I thought Aurora and Brody, the two girls, I didn't realize they were with the same group. They're there at the beginning at the campfire. I just thought when he crosses that lake house, or seemingly a lake house there, I just thought those two girls were, well, this is just another, you know, couple kids he just runs across. But I realized later they're actually there with the other kids in the camp. They just, they must be located right next to that dock in the water. And so they go down there in the morning. And then what a great scene that is when he just kind of walks into the water.
Oh, yeah. And I mean,
you just imagine him walking all the way to her.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, like, that's the sort of thing. Like, when you see, like, in Friday Part 6, when Jason walks into the water, you know, it's like, it's not the same. You watch Johnny walk into the water, it looks like... You can imagine him just walking slowly along the bottom of the lake, right to where he's going. When Jason walks into the water in Part 6, you know, you kind of get the idea he's, like, swimming or something under the water. It doesn't feel like the same mechanical, like, I'm going that way and nothing is stopping me. I'm just going to keep going. You know what I mean? It seems... With Johnny, it seems more almost animalistic in a way. In like, I want to get from point A to point B, straight line, go. Like, you know, there's like no... I don't even know what word I'm looking for.
Well, it's subtle.
Yeah. It is.
It's subtle. And I almost don't like the idea. It hits me better now, but I almost don't like the idea that her body even floats up to the top. I think it would have been pretty crazy, man, if it would have just, she comes up once, screams, goes back down, never see her again.
Yeah. And then maybe like some blood comes up or something, but that would be it.
Then he just walks up out of the water, you know, almost Friday 7. You know, way, you know, where, and then of course it's on to Aurora and that, and the infamous yoga. See, but
I love the yoga death. So, it is one of the greatest deaths in modern film history.
Let's just run through the cast real quick of the two films. And maybe that'll spring us off into a couple directions real quick. So in Violent, start there. Cause that's the smaller cast. You've got, I'm just going to go in the order they die. You've got, the trapper we mentioned, then you roll on into Aaron, who is the one who tells the story at the campfire. He gets it with the raw knife. Brody, of course, presumably drowns, however it is he kills her in the water. Aurora, the infamous yoga scene with the dragon hooks, which is amazing because I just love the execution when she turns and sees him and screams and immediately – she realizes she's on the edge of the cliff and she turns and she's got nowhere to go. It almost reminds you in a weird way of Zombie, the girl that just stands there and looks in terror and can't, you know, well, where, what is she going to do? And before she can even think anything, I mean, it's game is on with her. Then you move on to Evan, who gets the flying axe, while Troy is, which, you know, he's the one you want to hate because he's the one who takes the pen in. He's a jerk. Mm-hmm. His head is crushed with a rock. Colt, in the end, gets, well, actually, before him, Ranger, the infamous log splitter scene with him. You find out there is a real history between him and Johnny. And then Colt, somehow, some reason, Colt just maybe gets the worst brunt of his anger. I don't know. It's weird. And then Chris, our final girl, of course, you know, makes it out of there. And the great drive scene with our Vicky Friday 2 is so freaking awesome. But then in Burning, I had to, this was tough. I really had to look at this junk and really sort some things out. So you really got to break it with the Burning. I think the best way is to break it in three groups of people. All right. So you got, just get Alfred out of the way. You got Alfred. Okay. Freaking punk creep kid. He's the one you're supposed to empathize, whatever. You're supposed to feel sorry for, which I don't. I freaking hate this kid by the end of this movie. I want this kid to freaking die so freaking bad. I actually freaking love Glazier by the end of this movie. At least before he dies. I think Glazier ends up being a pretty good, I'll say why if I don't forget. Well, I may forget. So the scene with him and is it Sally? Yeah, him and Sally. After he has that failed moment with her in the sack, and he just, yep. I thought this was actually a pretty brilliant scene where he's waiting for, like Cropsey, he's waiting for the rejection. Mm-hmm. And the surprise is she doesn't reject him. She says, no, I want to be with you. I want to stay. And you see this moment where Glacier's not a bad guy. Like, he just wants to be, he wants that attachment. He wants to know he's with someone who wants to be with him.
Yeah.
Right. And I think from that point on, he's actually pretty, he's really likable, not unlike freaking Alfred. You get Glazier and Sally together. You got Todd and Michelle. They're the camp counselors. Todd, of course, is the ringleader of the prank gone bad. And then Karen and Eddie. Eddie is the real freaking jerk. And thankfully, I think Eddie's on the first raft out of there. Karen, of course, she, you know, so then you got that group, but then you got the first raft. That's the second group. You got Eddie, Fish, Woodstock, Diane, Barbara, those kids. It's like two guys and three girls, I think. And then you've got the second raft, the raft out, the survivors, which include Holly Hunter, who we don't see a whole lot, is Sophie, Jason Alexander, George Costanza for Seinfeld.
I still can't get over seeing him with hair.
Freaking awesome, man. And a lot of his mannerisms as George are in this movie. Oh, yeah.
Definitely. You see it and you're like, okay, yeah, this is what George Costanza was like when he was young and in, like, summer camp.
And he's one of the few people that can actually talk to Glazier at the beginning.
Yeah.
When Glazier sort of unloads on him a little bit in the cafeteria, and Jason, and Dave's like, "What's going on? Come on!" And he's the only one can get him to calm down.
Mm-hmm.
But dude, Alfred is just a freaking creep, man. You got Tiger, which is a weird, that girl. It's hard not to look at her for some reason. I don't know why. She's just got that weird look. Marnie and Alan and Rhoda. Led by Michelle, gets them out of there. So you got three, four, five, six, seven on that raft who get out of there. The five get wasted on the first raft. And then you got that other group, which, you know, I think, Karen goes first. Karen goes first, and then, I don't see where I have number two, but Karen goes... Glazier and Sally go. So, like, they go because they go off and they're doing their own thing. Eddie tries to get Karen, and Karen, now there you go, Karen rejects him.
Mm-hmm.
And he throws, man, he throws a tantrum, but he lets her go, and of course, to her demise. And then, you know, so that, it's just interesting how you got all those freaking people out there. And yeah. Her, you know, and how he just, you know, and probably that raft sequence was ingenious, because you just took out five.
In one shot.
And then you could take your time with a few others in the group.
And we also got to say, you know, he took out five people on a raft with garden shears. You know, it's not like he came in with a machete, like, swinging. It's not like he came in, like, with his flamethrower, which right. is freaking awesome. You know, he came in with a pair of garden shears and took out five people in a matter of, how long's the scene? Like, a minute?
Yes, not that long.
A minute and a half? You know? If that doesn't say badass, I don't know what does. Yeah. And, I mean, can you tell me of a more iconic scene than just him coming up with the pruning shears or whatever?
Yeah. And it's terrifying, man. And I mean, you could say, well, just jump in the freaking water and start swimming. Well, I mean, you're coming up on a freaking canoe. The last thing you expect is this freaking monster to just freaking boom, tower, like zombie, tower over you. And then once the blood shower goes, I mean, what do? You just sit there in terror and just watch these people just start getting butchered in the finger snips. Oh, man. And the look on the kid's face, too, is crazy, oh, yeah. man. The way his eyes go wide and his face is like, I just watched all my fingers go pship off.
Yep. Man, it's... And I just love the fact, though, that, you know, he's wiped out this raft, and then he just leaves them all on it. Doesn't try to hide the bodies or anything, no, just, there you go.
Now, isn't there a deleted scene that gives you more of the raft when it's coming back?
I think so.
Yeah.
Because
the carnage doesn't look that bad in the theatrical or even in the uncut. But it seems like there's a deleted scene, though, that just seems to show you more of the carnage on the raft as it's floating up the river, a longer.
Yeah,
it's Alfred. Alfred is a freaking creep. Alfred, I so badly when he is sort of against the wall of the short little, you know, and Cropsy's up on top holding on the shears. It so badly wanted to see those shears just drop and go right through his freaking head. Todd, I don't know. It's almost like he shouldn't have been allowed to get out of there for what he did. But then again, you got Cropsy, who's just, you know, I mean, he's a terror to these kids. So, I mean, it's kind of like,
yeah, I mean, it's the sort of thing where you look at it and it's like, yeah, like when the events of the prank first happened, Cropsy had been a dick, but he hadn't really done anything to deserve it.
Well, he beat one of them up, I think. They talked about in the beginning.
Something like that, you know. But I mean, you know, like he hadn't like gone slaughtering them or anything, but it makes you wonder, was this something always lurking beneath the surface?
Well, yeah, he probably was a little disturbed. I mean, probably shouldn't have been a caretaker at a summer camp.
Yeah. I mean, it's a perfect example of this. I've said before about the Nightmare on Elm Street remake and, like, how I would have done it. And I would have done it that, you know, Freddy Krueger wasn't actually, hadn't done anything. But he was planning it. I wonder the same about Cropsy. You know, Cropsy at that point hadn't really done anything. But if he'd just been left to his own devices, maybe he would have. You know? Like, was that already there to begin with? And if so, you know, was that something that these kids just sort of inherently kind of realized? Because, I mean, you got to reckon there's probably more than one jerk at this summer camp. But this is the one they wanted to pull this prank on. You know, so did they kind of see something there that, you know, the rest of us didn't?
Well, you know, it's funny because, you know, from the last time, I think the last viewing of The Burning I got, I almost, maybe it was a force, maybe it was, maybe I forced it, but I mean, I almost got a sense that Cropsey sort of had a connection to Alfred in the sense that they both had something wrong with them. Now, I know he uses Alfred to kind of draw Todd in there, you know, because that's who he wants in the end. But the fact is, he doesn't kill Alfred. He ties him up to that pole or whatever. He keeps him pinned there with the shears. But I don't think he has any intentions of killing Alfred. Why?
Because
he knows Alfred's a freaking creep?
Maybe, yeah. Maybe like he sees something himself there, yeah.
Kind of like that scene in Halloween Ends between Michael and the kid, right?
Yeah.
He just sees something off kilter in his eye. He sees something. Because, I mean, think about the prank almost gone bad where Alfred's acting the peeping Tom on Sally in the shower at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
The motivation was to get back at Glazier.
Yeah.
Well, you have to be freaking stupid. You know, you're gonna, you know, Glazier is the kid that you just don't want to mess with. He's gonna pound you into the freaking ground, and so mm-hmm. you're going to freaking get back at him by targeting his girlfriend, or at least the one he wants to be with, who he's got an eye for.
Yeah,
I mean you gotta have something just wrong with you. I mean,
yeah you do.
I mean. And then, okay, that reminds me of the scene. How about this for one of the most cringe, awkward moments in either of these movies? When Glazier leaves Sally, goes back to the camp to get his matches, and Alfred's pretending to be asleep, and then Alfred follows Glazier back. There's a moment just as Glazier is approaching Sally, doesn't know she's been killed, right? At least from the camera vantage, it almost appears as though as Alfred is only like 2 feet behind him. Yeah. How the heck does he not know Alfred is freaking following after him in the woods with all the... It's just like when Johnny approaches the yoga girl, she knows someone's behind her because he steps on the twig.
Yeah.
Dude, you're telling me your Glazier's running almost full speed. I mean, he's running through the woods. Alfred's got to run to keep up with him. And you don't hear this kid behind you in the middle of the night? But that was just a creepy scene. And then again, what is Alfred after? A peep show. He wants to, you know, he wants. And then it's like you can't even really judge the look on Alfred's face when he watches Glazier get it with the shears.
Mm-hmm.
There's almost like for a moment, there almost is like a look of joy.
Yeah. Like
he's seeing the one who he hates more than anyone. He's seeing him just get brutalized.
Hmm.
I don't know, man. I don't like Alfred at all. I don't like him at all. He should have died. He should have.
Maybe that's what we'll subtitle this episode. I don't like Alfred.
I don't like Alfred. I don't like his name. I don't like him. I just think this guy is a freaking. I think, you know, it's funny. I think, in fact, Todd should have freaking died too. I mean, the ringleader of the freaking prank, he should have died. Alfred should have died. And you know who your hero should have freaking been? Not Todd, who gets a light swipe and then recovers and gets back into the. It should have been Glazier, man. Glazier should have got the light swipe, and Cropsey should have went after Alfred or something. And then you know, maybe thinking, well, you know, I'll get back to Glazier. And then Glazier comes in at the end and puts Cropsey out of his misery, and he becomes the hero of the movie.
That could have worked.
It would have been a nice arc from the beginning, and when you first meet him, oh, this guy's just a bully. He's, you know, he just, you know, likes his cannon fodder. But, you know, it's kind of like we talked about with Texas, the last Texas movie, you know, the character arc that could have been, you know, in that movie, which could have been great. But, you know, so you have, interesting. You have a film that never got a sequel.
Mm-hmm.
Never been remade.
Yep.
Just sort of left alone. And now you've got Violent Nature. You've got a sequel coming.
Mm-hmm.
Presumably, it may, like Terrifier, it may follow suit and be the next franchise.
I don't have a problem with that.
No. And to put this in your lap here for a few minutes, you said something earlier about, maybe it was before we started recording, because I agree with you completely, but I want to hear your take on how it should go. Mm-hmm. The sequel needs to be different.
Definitely. Sequel to, you can't capture lightning in a bottle twice. We know that for a fact. We've seen it time and time again, where you have like a neat idea for the first movie and it works, and then you replicate it for the second and it's just blah, you know? No, they need to switch it up. I think what they need to do for this, for the sequel to In a Violent Nature, they need to do like a proper, you know, summer camp slasher film. You know, like old school, like Friday the 13th style slasher film. And give us more with this character that we've seen do all these things in the first movie. We know how he does them now. Show us from the other people's point of view. Show us from the people that, you know, like how we normally would see it. That's what I would do, you know, and just make it a really good, solid slasher film. You know, don't get too meta with it. Don't get like get preachy or anything. Just give us a good, solid slasher film and you will be set. The character you and the design is like iconic enough that I could see, you know, many sequels. You know, would they be, you know, diminishing returns? Probably, but you know, jump around, like I said, do a proper like subjective camera type thing. For the second one. Then do a third one. Maybe do it found footage. Then do a fourth one. Maybe do it, you know, as like a horror comedy or something. You know, you can do anything, really. But, yeah, don't try to do the same thing as the first one. Because you can't do it.
You know, here's an interesting idea. You know, mm-hmm. I've always been amazed by the transition that takes place between Rec 2 and Rec 3, when you get so far into the Rec 3 film and you go from where the overweight guy, camera guy can't get up into the crawl space thing, whatever. And when he drops the camera, that ends your found footage and it becomes a movie.
Yeah.
So, you know, I was just thinking, you know, because we mentioned how, you know, with his dad, at least as far as what we're given, there's that sort of that Pumpkinhead vibe, sort of his dad just pushed to the edge of, I lost my son, you took my son. And there's that huge thing. Well, you know, it'd be interesting. You know, you put the sequel, and who knows how Chris Nash is going to do it, but you put the sequel a little bit of time, you know, somehow, some way, Johnny's been laid to rest again.
Mm-hmm.
And you use the Pumpkinhead story. So the legend is already concrete, and the legend of the pennant or the pendant is out there. And someone gets wronged in an absolutely terrible way. And so they fling fate to the air, and somehow they know if they can get a hold of this pendant and tag it to the person that wronged them, Johnny's going to go after them. Now, Johnny doesn't care that they're not the ones who took it from him. He just knows that's who has it.
Yep, and he wants it back.
Yeah, and that could lead you into an actual summer camp type, type if that's, and that would be, and then, don't rip off the whole movie, but I mean, maybe there's a point where the person who does it starts to realize what they've done is, works on their conscience a little bit and maybe tries to be the one to undo it somehow. But, you got to have a score too, I think. I think maybe you got to change it up a little bit, make it. Because and it's interesting how The Burning never got a sequel, never been remade, but with In a Violent Nature, this movie, I think, and I hope for a lot of people, has just gotten better and better every time they've watched it.
Yeah, I believe that.
Actually, what I was thinking of was not with The Burning as much, but with Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
Even though we'll probably eventually get a sequel at some point, maybe. To be honest, repeat viewings of Nature has been better for me than Thanksgiving has been. I still want my sequel.
Oh, yeah. So do
I. I want that to, hopefully be, pushed in an interesting, unique way. It'd be interesting what Roth comes up with for that. But for this is you really. It's, I mean, you got the whole world in front of you and what you could do with this.
Yeah.
And what I don't want is a prequel. I don't want a prequel. I really don't want to see the loggers. I don't know. I think the story was told well enough. You can imagine in your head. It's just like, I don't know. It's like Crystal Lake being done on Peacock, if it ever gets done.
Yeah.
Do we really want to see Mrs. Voorhees in the 50s? Do we really want to see Jason? I mean, because however that happens, it's not going to play out as well as played in our minds, imagining how all that went down.
The only way I think you could do a prequel to In a Violent Nature would be, like you said, you'd have to tell the story of the loggers or whatever, but I think what would be more interesting would be a prequel about the ranger guy. I'd like to see that story, him and his friends when they went there and, how that played out before, what led to that level of violence that Johnny inflicts on him.
Yeah.
What did he do that caused that much rage? Because he spends more time on him than any of the other characters.
Yeah, you're right.
Even the awesome yoga kill is not as brutal as his death. And, that kind of rage just doesn't happen. That comes from somewhere. Tell us that story.
Okay, well, let's try to remember this, because we do get dialogue, and it seems like the ranger, his dad is involved, because doesn't his dad at one point put him down, or was his dad a part of the original?
I think his dad was part of the original thing. Okay. That's what I seem to think.
And then
sometime later on, he comes back, when him and his friends are there or whatever, right. And they all get killed, but he survives, and, you know. Yeah, tell us that story.
So with the son this time, instead, you know, dad puts him down the first time. Yeah, because that's right, because he does say that his dad's the only survivor. And that's the part of the story that doesn't get told often, is that his dad, there was a survivor in the massacre. Yeah. His son, though, has to do what his dad did, and he puts him down. So, yeah, there is an intriguing story there.
Yeah. So, yeah, I would go there. I would, you know, leave the actual, like, origin story, if you will. Leave that just to be in our imagination. Let's say this. Say that In a Violent Nature is part three. Give us part two, but don't give us part one. You know? Yeah, give us like what happened like 10 years ago, not what happened like, you know, 40 years ago.
I almost wish they could have wrote something really freaking creative for that ending story of the bear. Oh, yeah. I wish they could have wrote something in there that you would have only thought about after, like, having seen the movie 20 times. Yeah. That you would have suddenly went, whoa, wait a minute. That's the freaking ranger. That's what freaking happened. I wish they would have did something like that. Just a little something in the end that maybe would have just gotten it a little bit. Hey, remember that? Right? Don't forget about that guy.
Yeah, that would have been great, honestly.
You know.
I mean, yeah.
But don't just make like it obvious.
Yeah, like have something like, you know, the ranger has like a name tag on, and like, you know, the girl at the end in the car has like an ID there, and it's the same last name or something.
Or you could have just done something crazy, like you could have just, you know, had Lauren Marie Taylor's character. I guess she's just known as the woman who picks her up at the end. If she would have just said something to the effect of, you know, because there's the conversation about what set the bear off or why was the bear, because the bear was just killing to kill. It wasn't even eating its food that it was killing. It was just mutilating it, leaving it, and just leaving a trail of just bloodlust. You could have wrote an interesting line in there, you know, where the woman telling a story could have said something, just something, you know, well, you know, some have thought, you know, or some have suggested that, you know, somebody set that bear on a war path. But just leave it. Make it so subtle, so random, just sort of a thought, you know, and just, you know, because she's just trying to talk to keep the girl, you know, keep her awake, you know, because she's losing blood. Just something so. And that's when you just suddenly start thinking, wait a minute, did this ranger do something? Did the son of the guy who first put him in, did he do something to him? Because there seems to be an implication that something happened.
Yeah.
Because there's real intent and purpose to how he latches onto him. Right from the beginning of the movie to the log splitting scene.
Yeah. I just thought of something that could have worked. And I mean, I just think it would have been kind of hilarious if you did this. She tells that story about the bear and everything, and then it'd be just a thing, did they get the bear? And be like, yeah, they found it dead about, you know, like a couple hours later. It was loaded with cocaine. and just be, you know, that thing for that few hours, that was the most deadliest predator on the earth, and that's what was going on. That was, you know. And turns out that In a Violent Nature is actually a sequel to Cocaine Bear.
Or in a smart way, the cocaine is just a metaphor for the pendant because you're really talking about Johnny and not a bear.
Yeah.
Oh, which it probably man. Was a bear. I mean, it is. I mean, when she, you get, it feels like 15 minutes of film, but when her, it's her brother, right? That gets attacked.
Yeah.
And he's in the creek and he thinks, cause he finds no tracks on the other side. So he figures the bear's just gone upstream.
Yeah.
And that's when suddenly he realizes it's too late. The bear just gnaws right down on the back of his head and he just pushes him into the water and seemingly he drowns and the bear thinks he killed him. So the bear just wanders off and.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is like if a bear was doing that, you know, I don't think a bear would care if you drowned. I think it would still bite down and take your head off.
Well, what did the woman say? She said that the old timers called it henhouse disease or something.
Yeah.
She called it something. It's kind of like when it's kind of like in The Thing when what's his name said I don't know, maybe cabin fever.
Yeah.
You know, it's just something set that bear off and that bear just, but that ends up being the perfect metaphor for Johnny. And okay, so this is a question I have. So when they stop and you can't, even though you've seen it 5-6 times now, you can't help to think that Johnny is in those woods looking.
I know, you keep looking for it just to be.
I looked again. The last time I watched it last night, I had it on my bigger TV. I'm staring, and I'm like, "Where is the outline? Where's the shadow?" Surely Chris Nat put him in that frame somewhere. Maybe he's so far back in the brush, but he's there.
I kind of love the idea though that you know he got his necklace back, and it was just like, "Okay, I'm going back to bed."
But you know, if he was somewhere hidden in the brush and somehow bait just landed him near the roadside and he's eyeing the vehicle like he did a few times throughout the movie, just eye things. And then I imagine he's in there and he realizes it's Chris, but he realizes she is the one of all the kids. She's the one that gives him the pendant back, leaves him the pendant. And so you almost kind of get this kid-like gesture of, you know, thank you, I got my pen. Thank you for this.
That would be kind of cool.
Yeah, I'm leaving you alone now. Thank you. And he, you know, but I just wonder what happens to him. Where? See, you almost have to wonder in the sequel. They're going to create a diversion between the point where he leaves from that gas can with the pendant, making his way back to the fire tower. Something is going to happen between A and B that's going to redirect him into another hour and a half of carnage.
They could definitely do that. Yeah. I don't know.
It's interesting. I'm about as excited for this that I have been. Okay, so I watched, or maybe I read, I think I read about this. Chris Nash, you know, the water scene is one of my favorite moments in the entire movie. I just love how you just see her, and you kind of, all the times we've seen Jason go in the water and pull someone down, and he actually wanted the camera somehow use a crane, like a modified crane system to put the camera right over the water, looking straight down. And he wanted you to be able to see, at least as blurry as it would have been, he wanted you to see shapes underwater moving.
That would be cool.
That would have been. But somehow the camera or something didn't work with it. They tried several times and then he just gave up and realized we got to come up with a simpler way to pull this off. And there were a lot of moments like that for him in this movie that makes you wonder if he ever gets more money, more resources, what we might get. It's exciting.
Yeah. Yeah, that's something I find a lot. I think the biggest example of that is the movie Malum, which is a remake of the movie Last Shift. That's it. The same director made the movie, and it's a remake of his own movie. And what you see there is, you know, what he wasn't able to do in the first movie, he's done in the remake. So it makes you wonder, you know, like with this, what, you know, if he could have got that shot he really wanted, you know, if he'd had the money to do it and had the, you know, the time and everything, maybe we'll get a situation like that, you know, where we get to see it fully realized. I don't have a problem with that at all.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because you kind of know what you're going to get with Roth, and you kind of know, you know, a lot of times you know what you're sort of going to get, but with this one, you're not sure what you're going to get.
No. And like I said, as long as he's smart, and I think judging from In a Violent Nature, he's a smart director. He won't try to do it again. He'll try something else. And I hope that's the case. You know, essentially give us your version of Aliens. You know, go a different way than the original and just, you know, I don't mean make it an action movie, but, you know.
Yeah, make it fun. Make it really.
Yeah.
Like,
don't just try to reproduce something that can't be reproduced.
Amp it up without amping it up.
Yeah.
You know, push it without pushing it, you know, and you know, yeah.
I would say this, definitely up the kill count. That's just a given, you know, but also, hello. Also, my cat just jumped up behind me. Also, you know, we're in the age of Terrifier. You know, we're in the age of that log splitter kill. Give us more of that.
And you make know
it,
what?
Make it hurt. You
to
know?
That, to that point, what I thought was really one of the ways that it sort of turn the era of the slasher film on its head, so to speak, was his restraint in not showing us a lot of things you're accustomed to in the slasher.
That's true.
Gratuitous nudity, you know, sex scenes, you know.
Even save it for the sequel.
Or don't at all. Or just, you know.
Yeah.
Keep your film and offer something that you're still giving, you know, the kills, you're doing it all of this, but somehow I think if you avoid one positive of avoiding, you know, some of the gratuity in other areas is you're retaining some originality that this is your film, your franchise. And
yeah,
people will walk out of it thinking, you know, this isn't like your run of the mill. What is it that's different? And they might not even realize it or think about it, you know, or suddenly maybe they're like, hey, wait a minute. You never did see this or that. I think maybe in part that's where the Friday remake went wrong. I think the Friday remake took what it assumed was expected, but blew it out of proportion too much. Had the Friday remake been more like In a Violent Nature?
Yeah.
Tempered in certain areas, but explosive in others. It might have garnered its own, okay, next film.
Could be.
Instead of, you know, being thrown on the heap of forgot that one. although it does have some nice visual moments in there. But okay, so one thing, okay, so with the burning, nothing ever again. But I did watch today, Tony Malam. He didn't hardly make any movies after this.
Yeah.
And I thought I heard or read somewhere where how this production ended didn't go the way he wanted to. I think there was somehow him and the Weinsteins didn't see things the way they should. And I don't know. It seemed like this, you know, it was another episode of, you know, things that we're too accustomed to hearing too much. But I did see his film from 79 today, The Riddle of the Sands. It's so crazy to see a director who would do something like The Burning, but then see something they did, which really was sort of a, I don't know how you even label it, sort of an espionage period piece, you know, that involves, you know, a supposed land, you know, invasion of England by Germany in 1901, which it just, you know, with Michael York and, you know, our girl from American Werewolf in London and our shark killer from Jaws 3D. And it was just amazing, not to get too far deep into it. It was just amazing, though, you have a director like Tony Malam directing a film like that and how he got to work with those characters, those actors. And there is a lot of good stuff in The Burning, and it just makes you wonder what that movie would have been like if he had got his complete and total way, creative, artistic way. Mm. But in the end, he probably didn't get robbed like a lot of people get robbed, you know.
That's true. That's true.
I think in the end, it's pretty iconic. It's got some of the best poster images and, you know, Cropsey. I did see the interview with, was it Lou, what's Cropsey? The guy who plays Cropsey is, that's his name, Lou David, I think. Lou David?
I think it's
Lou David. It is Lou David. He did, maybe we could end somewhat close to this. He did say, it was one of those interviews where the person, you don't get to hear the person speaking to him. You just hear his reactions to the questions.
I hate those
interviews. Yeah. But it's like the person asked something like, could you ever see Cropsey be reborn or, you know, continued along? And he, I don't know, it seemed kind of funny at first, but I the more I thought about it, he said, you know, in his mind, he likes to think that there's a little bit of his protoplasm left behind in the woods that over time just kind of grew back into another Cropsey. But I thought about that.
I thought,
actually, what if you did do a sequel all these years later? And what you did is you just sort of recreated that final scene, the aftermath of it, you know, what was left of it. And you sort of had his body laying there and just, you know, a random fox comes along sniffing the bodies and just starts chewing on him, gets infected with the Cropsey, like a form of rabies, and then ends up biting someone, attacking someone, infecting them, and they become the Cropsey.
That would be kind of cool. I mean, I wouldn't have a problem with it.
I don't know. I mean, it's a stretch, but I mean, what movies aren't a stretch? Yeah. I mean, you know.
That's true.
So, you know, but so yeah, it is interesting. These two movies are, I think, closer to each other than I think these two movies are a lot closer. And also, too, the focus on nature. Both films go way out of their way to just consider nature. And both take a killer who basically dispatches someone almost for the sake for their surroundings, because the surroundings are so beautiful, and yet these people are intruding into these surroundings. I don't know, it might be a little bit artsy, but it's just interesting how the two sort of reflect each other more than either reflect Friday in their own way. I don't know.
That's true. You know what? I just had a thought. When you said like artsy and everything, I just thought, could you imagine if you take The Burning and what you essentially do is you take the movie, is it Don't Look in the Attic or Don't Look in the Basement? That one about that guy that like burns women alive and stuff.
Oh yeah. I think that's don't. Is that Don't Go in the House or Don't Go in the Basement?
Don't Go in the House. Don't go.
It's one of those don't do that for us.
Yeah. Could you imagine though if like that guy was Cropsey? It would explain the flamethrower. You know, it would explain the rage of being like burned. Because that's something he does to, I don't know, I just thought, like, that could have been an interesting little thing. Like, if you could edit the movies in such a way that, you know, that guy is actually working at, like, a summer camp.
Yeah.
Well, I'm just saying.
Have you ever heard, looking back, have you ever heard whether Tom Savini wishes he could have done Friday 2 rather than The Burning, or do you think he's always been?
I think The Burning is what how can I put this way? I get the feeling that when he did The Burning, they essentially just said to him, go wild.
Yeah.
Like, do what you want. You know, we know what you're capable of. Have at it. And I think, as a result, he would always take The Burning because of that. You know, I would have liked to have seen what he could have done in Friday 2. Also, I would have liked to have seen what he could have done in Friday 3.
Yeah.
You know, I would have really liked to have seen Tom Savini 3D effects. Because, well, I mean, you know,
it might be a case of Savini to Friday 3D to what could have been Spielberg to Return of the Jedi.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh,
we'll always wonder what that movie would have been had he done it.
Oh, yeah.
It's still great, but it is, so, all right. Well, I think we pretty much maybe exhausted it. Okay. Favorite kill from each movie.
Okay. From The Burning, it has to be the raft scene. I mean, there's like five kills in a matter of like a minute and a half. Yeah. What, you know, and just the sticking the shears right like in the neck, you know, that part was great. As for In a Violent Nature, it's the yoga scene, best use of a hook and a head I've seen in a long time, and I appreciate just the pushing her off the cliff at the end also. You know, just get out of here.
I think I'm going to go with the raft scene as well. But I think I appreciate more, even more than the opportunity of just the gore galore moment. I appreciate more that we get to see the raft come back.
Oh, yeah.
And it's just littered with bodies. That, to me, makes that scene work more than anything. If we would have never saw that raft again after that moment, as great as that moment is, it would have been easier to forget. But the fact that you get the raft back.
Yeah.
Makes it, because I think seeing the raft from a distance is more horrifying because you know what took place and you know what's on the raft.
Yeah.
Right. So I think
I was thinking, I was wondering, do you think that scene would have worked? Oh, am I bleeding? Yeah, I'm bleeding, right, you know.
Well, it's just laughter.
Yeah, it's reached the real world. Could you have imagined that if they hadn't shown the actual attack on the raft and it had just been, you know, the raft coming down the thing, someone swims over, and it's just a bloodbath?
That could have worked.
It could have worked, but would it have been effective without having seen what happened?
Well, here's here's what you would have got, I think. Mm. Without the gore galore moment, without the MPAA having to deal with that scene, you could have got away with way more showing the aftermath than you could have ever shown the moment it takes place. But it would have to be. I think it would work because I think a lot of those kids are really likable, and you still have quite a few of them that you know could fall victim, not knowing that a good chunk of them are going to get back. Because I think what's really effective too is remember when they get back and Michelle goes up because the other counselor there doesn't believe her. And he's like, oh, come on. You know, what's his name? David? No, Todd. Todd put you up to this. You up to this. And she's like, look at those kids. Look at them. And you can see from his vantage, looking at them, just they look like they just been through hell.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, because you have great effective moments throughout in terms of how you're supposed to feel for these kids, I think it could have worked. But to your point though, I think the fact it does work so well because you get that scene.
Yeah.
But it could have worked the other way. I think it really could have, because if you would have saw those five kids, well, here's the thing. If you put five kids on there and they're the five kids that you have no reason not to like.
Yeah.
It's effective. But the fact you got Eddie on there and you've got, you know, a couple of, you know, I mean, some of the girls didn't do anything wrong. I mean, they, you know, but Eddie, you sure don't like Eddie. Because even with Karen's disappearance, he seemingly has no remorse, which makes Eddie much more of a villain than Glazier.
Mm-hmm.
Glazier wants a relationship. He wants something long term. Eddie wants a quickie and be done with it and move on.
Mm-hmm.
You don't buy any of the junk he says to her in the water.
No.
But you might not have believed Glazier in the beginning, but afterwards you believe what he had said earlier.
Mm.
Because what he's after and what Eddie are after are two totally different things, I think. Yeah. And that's what makes Eddie a scoundrel. He is just, he, for that reason, Alfred, just because he's a creep. And Glazier should have been the hero. But okay, so I've been thinking about in the violent nature, I make a big deal about the water scene, but since when you say favorite kill, you expect gore.
Oh yeah.
So I'm going to take a different route than you.
Okay.
You ready?
Yep.
Because every time I see this scene play out, I'm more amazed by it. Aaron I always forget what it's called. Kind of a knife, is it? The draw knife. When he's just saying, oh, that practical. I mean, when he brings that thing into the tree and there's a moment where the body still leans against the tree and then it just falls.
Yep.
It's hard and not hard to actually watch Johnny with his hand buried into the skull, carrying his head and dragging his body. Cause you just can imagine, like, what is it? Yeah. I don't want to know what it feels like to have your fingers delved into someone's inner half cuts, you know, I don't know. That moment is, and I love the effect of the Walkman, how the Walkman just, the battery starts to go and it just starts to drown out. Like it did in the old days. That's what Walkmans would do when the battery started to go, which I thought was so Aaron against the tree. Because I think in the end, nice. Aaron's a good guy, and Aaron, I don't know if he deserves a death like that, especially assuming that he was abused by his uncle. That's kind of it's one of those weird side points that just gets thrown out there, and then you're meant to forget about it. It's like,
kind of like the chicken Friday 3, who's actually pregnant.
Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah, you always forget
about that. Yeah, you totally forget about that, but you know.
Yeah, Aaron. All right, who tells the story better? Todd at the campfire or Aaron at the campfire?
Ooh. I'm gonna say Todd. Yeah. Aaron's one is great, but you know, it's just maybe because of the nature of in a violent nature, the fact that you're, you know, like following the killer's point of view and everything, it's not something what's the word I'm looking for? It's like you're not part of that scene. That's just something that's happening. You know what I mean? Whereas in The Burning, you know, like you are part of that scene because that's the story that's being told. You know, it's being told to us on purpose. We're not like it's being told and the camera just happened to pick up what was being said.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think I'll go with Aaron just because I think it's, well, two reasons. I think it's more tragic that he tells the story and seemingly has done nothing to deserve, you know, his fate. And I think it's also intriguing because of the camera, they get Johnny in the picture in the background.
Hmm.
Which is brought up towards the end, like, you know, it's almost like Brody from Jaws 2, you know. That's a shark. Yeah. That's a shark. You can tell me I don't know what a shark looks like. I've been through that hell once before, and I ain't going through it again. I love it how she's like, there's someone in this picture. Look. It reminds you of Friday 2 when they go into the dark room, when they come, you know, after they've been out at the tavern, they come back, and she's like, there's someone in this room. There's somebody in this room. And of course, Jason's off in the corner, you know. For Todd, Todd, what makes that weird, though, is he's the ringleader of the prank gone bad. He's telling the story, but he has a hard time remembering in the end.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just, there's a weird disconnect there that just doesn't work right. It's almost kind of like the end, whatever the end the director had envisioned is not the end we got, because it just seems like it should have been something different.
It seems to me almost that like Todd was supposed to be a different character, but then they were like, you know what, make him the ringleader of the group.
Yeah.
You know, like maybe he was just supposed to be just some guy, some camp counselor. You know, with no connection to it.
Yeah.
But then they thought, you know, we'll make a connection here. I don't know.
Yeah, because they never fleshed that out well.
I just thought of how in A Violent Nature, how you could have done that scene better. You know the scene where Johnny Zerny's playing with the little car and everything? If you had that scene happening at the same time as the guy telling the story. Like they're sat around this campfire and Johnny's over here behind like a tree, just sat there playing with the car. And it's almost like he's listening to the story while he's just, you know, doing that. Like, he's, you know. You know what I mean? Like, almost.
Yeah,
like,
that would have been really interesting.
He would have been there listening to his own story while he's just playing with this car. And you could even have something like, you know, not like, you know, you can only show so much with like a, you know, like a deformed looking character. You could almost have like a moment where it's almost like where he like remembers it, you know? Like we're sitting and like, you know, maybe he's playing with it and like he stops and like looks up or something just when he hears like a line of what he's saying or something. Just be like, kind of like, oh yeah.
Yeah.
I remember that.
Could have been it is amazing, you know? how often in Violent Nature somebody will get so close to Johnny without there's something happening.
Exactly.
But, you know, when the keys get thrown out, I think it's maybe it's cold. I can't remember which one, but he walks almost nearly to the tree.
Yep.
He's literally realize the there's a lumbering Hulk behind the tree. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's almost, and I've heard before, it's like the director, part of the motivation to do it in the way he did it was to sort of answer in a way, at least, why it is that everything we saw in slasher movies happened the way they did.
Mm-hmm.
Now you know how they happened.
Yeah.
Because you got to spend an hour and a half from the killer's point of view lumbering through the woods and being directed by sounds and, you know, whatever is directing him, he's, mm-hmm. you know, and you could now imagine, you know, not in a Friday remake type of way, but now you can, kind of think about Jason in the original movies. This is how he's being directed along.
Yeah.
It's by sound. It's by something happens, you know, where he kind of draws his attention and that's how he sort of appears. Of course, we always got that part of it, just him appearing out of nowhere, not the whole let's walk with him for 15 minutes and a sequence from A to B in the woods.
Yeah, true.
Well, it's funny because I really, you know, coming into today, I really started to think that this is actually where this conversation could go, and I think it actually went just like it. Because there's a lot to draw between these two movies. I think it's kind of amazing.
There really is. I mean, there is a lot more crossover than you really realize until you actually sit down and look at it. And you're just kind of like, oh, yeah, there is.
Yeah. So, yeah. So, yeah. We got Violent Nature Part 2 coming at some point. Got that to look forward to. And, we should probably plug the next Body Bags collaboration. The aim is to cover George A. Romero in a top five roundtable discussion with, you know, of course, we always do our honorable mentions outside of that five. So really looking forward to that. Closing out, where can people, whoever's gone with us this whole distance, where can they find you?
You can find me on YouTube at BDG Reviews, as well as you can find, well, these episodes, obviously, as well as being uploaded on Dark Discussions for podcasts. So, you know, Apple Music and like Spotify and all that, you can find it on there. Also, we upload these episodes to the Body Bags YouTube channel. So, you know, if you want to, if you're listening to this, you can see a video version over on YouTube. If you're watching this, you can find an audio version over on Spotify or Apple or whatever. That's it. Yeah, for me.
Let's not forget Lonnie, who couldn't be with us last minute, got dragged off to work. Was unfortunate, but Mr. McCobb's Movie Library is where you can find him. Brand new YouTube channel that he had to create. Very long story there, but definitely check out his new channel and sub him. VHS 82 apostrophe for me. Of course, on YouTube, Letterboxd, VHS82 without the apostrophe. And yeah, the collaboration videos on Body Bags and this podcast you're watching now or listening to now. And yeah, the last thing I did on my X-File or on my YouTube was wrapped up season 3 of the X-Files. So about to jump into season 4. So that's what, 73 episodes of the X-Files up there. So, you know, fan of the X-Files, there's 73 episodes waiting for you to be listened to. And Rob Zombie, my Rob Zombie collection.
Oh, yeah.
That as well. And when have you done, what's the last thing you did on your YouTube channel?
The last thing I did? The last thing I did was a review of... I don't know. I've just filmed a new like vinyl and music hall video that'll be going up pretty soon. So
nice.
Probably by the time you hear this, that will have been the latest video. I think I did a review of Wolfman, new Wolfman movie, and Nosferatu. Nosferatu good, Wolfman bad. Just saying.
There you go. Season finale for season 3 X-Files was pretty good.
Nice. But
the episode before that, Wet Wired, was freaking awesome. Sweet. That actually should have been your season finale. They should have somehow worked that into a season finale. Wet Wired was just a better... It was just a better episode. the last one did well to, you know, you start getting to see a lot of the mythology that you'll see in the movie Fight the Future. Heron Volk is the first episode of season 4. There's probably even more in that. You get a lot of the bees that you'll see in Fight the Future and just a lot of a lot of the stuff that you'll see in that movie between 5 and 6, seasons 5 and 6. So, anyways, all right. Yep. Well, there you go. Another nice conversation.
Oh, yeah. So, that's it. We will see you again next time. See ya.
All right. Good night.
Farewell and adieu to you, fair Spanish ladies. Farewell and adieu, you ladies of Spain. For we've received orders for to sail back to Boston. And so never more shall we see you again.